Welcome to the Stargate SG Fun Podcast. I'm Trish.
I'm Andrew.
And I'm David.
And we today are going to discuss 4 episodes, 1 very briefly and 3 in a bit more depth. And let's get started with a recap of Spirits from Season 2.
Spirits, SG-1 is sent to a planet with a newly discovered mineral named Trinium in order to bring back the missing team SG-11 and negotiate a mining agreement with the locals who are descended from Native Americans. SG-1 returns with what seems like SG-11, but they're actually the shapeshifter aliens who are posing as the locals' guardian spirits. These aliens get angry when they find out that Stargate Command is going to mine the planet with or without the locals' approval. This ends in a big confrontation where the aliens are finally convinced not to destroy Earth by receiving advice that they should have already known, such as, why not bury your Stargate if you're not using it? And, you know, you really shouldn't pose as divine beings to the humans on your planet. And it's all about as ridiculous as it sounds.
Yep.
I'm sure that sounded really good on paper before they made it, but it was probably a bad
idea.
There
are a few things that I like about this episode. Let's see. First of all, the Native Americans are descended from the Salish, so they are not generic Native Americans, and that is a good thing. I don't know how accurate they are, but at least they made some kind of effort in that direction.
Yeah, apparently Salish is like kind of a word that was applied after the fact to a lot more Native Americans than it was supposed to. So,
Well, I'm sorry.
It's not completely wrong, but it's...
All right. I do like that both Jack and Daniel make reference to the horrible history with Native Americans, especially with taking things from Native Americans and lying to them. And Hammond says, basically, orders are orders, and what they don't know won't hurt them, which turns out to be very wrong, right. Or rather, I don't know if they wouldn't have known, it might not have hurt them, but you really shouldn't assume that people on another planet may be ignorant, and they are obviously proven wrong yet again by another group of aliens that they dismissed as myth, despite being proven wrong several other times.
Over and over again, yeah.
Yeah, you really maybe ought to listen to the legends that people tell you, because often they are based on something. Is that all that I liked about the episode? It's certainly not important to the arc.
They mentioned Trinium in one more episode that we're going to go over today. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Which is actually ironic, considering they don't actually have that much Trinium, but...
Yeah. Well, anyway, that's all I wanted to mention.
The one kind of Native American who comes along back to the Stargate Command.
Tanani.
Through the gate and played by Rodney Grant, who I thought was in like everything for a while.
Yeah, I feel pretty sure I've seen him in something else.
Right. He was in Dances with Wolves is the biggie. So if you remember him, you probably remember him from that. But I thought he was like the Native American guy from a bunch of things. And it doesn't look like he was in that many, but he was in some. And, you know, he does fine. The thing that's more interesting to me than how the Stargate Command treats these locals and these aliens is how the episode treats them. Because I'm almost positive that the writers of this episode thought they were being totally respectful. And they do avoid a bunch of pitfalls that earlier shows probably did fall into. They're not figures of fun, these characters. They're not treated as ignorant. But the whole aliens are your gods thing is a lot more cringeworthy when it's a living culture than when it's people who were living thousands and thousands of years ago that are conveniently no longer around to object to things like that. And also like, okay, your gods are actually, though they're not their gods, they're still guardian spirits, but your gods are really ugly aliens, all played by white people. Again, it feels like they got through, you know, 101, but they didn't get through 201 in terms of how it works. So yeah. So they really should have just probably left it alone. And also, like, this comes back to also, these people were, according to the story, brought by the Goa'uld, which meant the Goa'uld were in, I guess, North America, South America, in addition to Egypt. It muddies the waters there, too. Although
But that's okay, though, because at least the time frame works.
That's it. Yeah, I guess, yeah.
I'll give it that.
Yeah, 5,000 years ago, I'm sure. But in any case, I'm already talking more than we need to about this. So we can move on.
All right.
I did not watch this episode, and I think I'm okay with that, but I will just let everyone know I am podcasting from the traditional unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Coast Salish peoples. Mm. A lot of meetings that happen in Vancouver, that is a thing that is often said to give some reference to the fact that everyone is having meetings in Vancouver and all of our land is unceded and is unceded to the Coast Salish peoples.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. There is some reason why that name may have been pulled up for a show that was written in Vancouver.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I probably did not pronounce those very well either. I'm sorry.
We do what we can, but... Okay, moving on to season 2, episode 14, Touchstone. And David, do you have a recap for this one?
I do. SGC PowerPoint Exposition tells us about a weather MacGuffin touchstone on Madrona. They discover Earthlings have stolen the touchstone. SG then figures out that the second Stargate from Antarctica was used. In Area 51, Mayborn acts surprised that the second Stargate has been replaced with, wait for it, a plastic prop. SG-1 cleverly sends a MALP to Earth's second Stargate from Madrona to use GPS to locate it. Hammond finds out exactly where the second Stargate is and SG-1 sneaks in. A civilian Black Ops crew escapes through the gate, but the touchstone is recovered and returned to Madrona. The second Stargate gets an iris welded on, but Mayborn is surprisingly smug.
Yep.
Surprisingly? Surprisingly... Maybe.
I was a little surprised because I believe that he was not expecting the Stargate to be plastic. I love the fact that the Stargate was plastic. They can just tap on it because it is just a plastic prop.
Yeah.
I like how I think Mayborn was in the dark initially. And then at the end of the episode, Mayborn seems less in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think there's smugness there. And maybe it's not surprising. Maybe that's just normal for Mayborn. But there's definitely a bit of almost an arc for Mayborn in this episode.
I would agree that to a certain degree, he seems like he might be puzzled about the gate. But there's that one moment where he's looking away from the team that it looks like he's like, oh, we've been caught. That's kind of how I interpreted that expression. And that made me think that he did know all along. And what was surprising him was that they were smart enough to actually check it or dogged enough to actually check it. So
that is definitely a possible interpretation. I think they really made it well that it could be interpreted either way.
Yeah, they were leaving it a little muddy,
which
considering that the show is all about the muddiness of this espionage heavy world. Sure.
I like the talk of the MacGuffin being a doohickey. I will use that term later in this podcast.
Is that a O'Neill term?
I believe so, yes.
I can't remember.
Yes. Yeah. I think he defends it as a technical term used by...
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
I believe that is the technical term.
Right. No. Let's see. I was interested near the beginning where Jack almost but not quite accuses Hammond of having something to do with... taking the artifact.
Yeah, second time he's done that.
Yep.
He carefully does not directly accuse him, but he certainly insinuates, and Hammond catches that insinuation and is fairly offended.
Yep.
But eventually backs down and says, yeah, sure, have Carter check stuff out.
I really like the line from Hammond regarding the Stargate. If a person sneezes near it, I get a report.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yep.
But this is definitely a continuing tension between Emil O'Neill and Hammond, like when the reporter was killed. And I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is reasonable because Hammond is such the rules follower.
Yes.
And if the chain of command required him to lie, he would lie.
Mm-hmm.
And O'Neill knows that. And I like it that they play it this way, where the two are fairly close. And the two have a degree of trust, but O'Neill does not quite trust the chain of command as much as Hammond does.
Right.
Well, the trouble is we just had an episode where Hammond follows orders to the detriment of a local population.
Mm-hmm.
And now this episode where Hammond like kind of goes completely out on a limb and kind of goes like all spy crafty in order to not screw over a native population. And I found, especially watching them when I run right after another, I found that to be pretty inconsistent. So, like, they're going to have Hammond be whatever he needs to be for the plot, instead of having the plot be written interestingly around a steady characterization. That was my thought with this anyway.
I did like that Hammond's version of a disguise when he's meeting with the guy in a suit is for Hammond to just wear civilian clothes.
Yep.
I had one question with the original meeting of the indigenous population, which is the leader blind?
I kind of had that feeling sometimes. He kept having the woman describes stuff to him.
I did not get that the first time I watched it. And the second time watching it, I was like, wait a second. Is he supposed to be blind? That would explain the acting. But they didn't quite communicate it. So it was interesting. A surprising subtlety, if that was the intent.
I think that was the intent. It's how it felt to me, too, anyway.
Yeah, certainly something weird going on. And it wasn't really that subtle.
The cause may have been subtle. It seemed more like he was on drugs was the other option.
Yeah, well, and it might have just been something that got cut because they didn't want to spend time on it. And this is another case where they're showing what seemed like maybe a Polynesian culture or something like that.
Maybe.
It might have also just been considered to be like a maybe a Middle American thing. And it's the same kind of thing, like everybody's kind of dressed in the, what presumably the writers or the costuming people thought was appropriate. This will be what'll look like that.
A bikini, right? A bikini, that was what was appropriate.
Yeah, well, that was like, yeah, wow, way to take off that cloak immediately, lady, as soon as the weather thing comes out. But yeah, that's the thing. Like, there was a lot in this episode which felt like it was kind of elongated because maybe they didn't have enough plot. Like, I know, David, you were saying they had a lot of plot. There was a decent amount of plot, but it still felt like they couldn't fill the time. So there were a lot of scenes with, like, people just saying things that were very normal that were kind of like stressed as if they were really dramatic moments of people talking. And I'm like, but just let's just move on. This wasn't really much to that.
The pacing was very slow in parts and I didn't mind it, but it definitely was okay. We're walking around now. Yeah. Okay. Here's some stock footage of a plane.
Right.
Okay. Here's another place where some people are talking.
Yeah.
I liked the episode. And then everyone on Madrona is like, well, okay, these are some costumes they threw together, and okay. It felt maybe there was some like budget constraints or something there, but...
Yes, I suspect you.
It worked reasonably well, but yeah, it definitely felt differently paced than a lot of previous episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to make a joke about the next one that they, you know, they're making Gravity. They're trying to make Gravity interesting for 40 minutes, and this one they're trying to make weather interesting for 40 minutes.
They did not succeed in doing that.
They did not really succeed in doing them.
I don't really think they were trying to do that. They were trying to make spycraft and interesting and competing bureaucracies.
They were trying to make their Jason Bourne movie, yeah.
Let's see, I did enjoy the character moment when Mayburn sees Teal'c and says, "It's good to see you, Will." And Teal'c says, "In my culture, I'd be well within my rights to dismember you." Yep. And there's a little moment later on when Mayburn has to go past Teal'c and he kind of hesitates and then scurries past, and Teal'c smirks. He positively smirks.
The smirk was great. Yeah, because that's like, oh, that's not just Teal'c being, you know, his usual self. That's like, oh, he's making a joke. He's not just making a joke, but you know.
I'm not sure he's joking, but he's definitely having fun.
I really like that. There's some other fun moments with Teal'c in these episodes too. So, you know, they're never really going to let him out of the straitjacket that he's kind of in. He's got to act in a very, very particular way most of the time. You know, they give him a little bit more in these episodes. So I did like what I got.
When they're trying to figure out whether it isn't their Stargate and it was the Antarctica Stargate, mm-hmm. I really quite liked that they go to a second backup and then they go to the third tier backup. Yeah,
right. Tertiary backup, yep.
No one would have thought to block the third tier, and they hadn't, yeah.
That was beautiful. There's times when this show is having fun. It's like, yep, three levels of backup. You guys know what you're doing. These guys know how to backup data. I don't know if it really was necessary. They didn't need to have a step where there was some data loss. It would have been fine if there wasn't. It just implies this dark civilian political organization out there has some fingers into the SGC.
Mm-hmm. I had not remembered that it was quite like this, that maybe the president isn't in on it, but like lots of very powerful people are trying to do very bad things.
Yes.
With the power of this thing. Is it entirely surprising that what was basically a colonial power who took advantage of a lot of people in other countries for many years would think to do the same, you know, 50, 70, 90 years later? No, but it is kind of interesting that this show, which is in many ways quite black and white about a lot of things, would be willing to portray the U.S. government that way when the U.S. government is generally supposed to be the good guy. But this is kind of saying, well, no, it isn't the good guy and you should probably not trust most of it.
The military are the good guys.
Oh, that, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Air Force good.
The politicians.
Politics bad.
Yeah, all right.
That is clearly the distinction this show would like to make.
Yeah.
I quite liked Hammond's backstory where they're discussing when the Stargate program was starting up, there was a faction that basically just said, we should go to these places and steal everything no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can imagine that someone would suggest that, and it's a horrible idea. There's a nice depth to SGC is like this for a reason, and Hammond is in this position for a reason. Is the other side won?
Right. Well, to talk competing bureaucracies for a minute, the extra site where they're doing the extra research, like, you know, studying the gold gliders and things.
Yeah.
You really have to question, you know, what kind of people are working for this thing? You know, their first indication that this device really is back on Earth is that there are a bunch of weather disasters in the United States, which kind of indicates that these people are just experimenting without any care or control conditions or anything. And this is the site, I believe, where they would have taken Teal'c to experiment on him in Bane when he had the bug metamorphosis thing going on. So, yeah, what kind of people, you know, here's a biolab, but I don't think we saw any people. So, I mean, certainly does not fill me with confidence that this would be a great place, even if it had ethics.
That was one aspect of the plot that confused me a bit. It seemed like they were saying that the pattern of weather allowed them to say that something was going on in Area 51. Or did they go there just because that's where they thought the Stargate was? Because I was trying to understand when I watched whether there was an implication that they thought the weather MacGuffin was actually there briefly or not.
I wasn't paying a lot of attention because there was a whole list of weather things that happened.
Yeah.
But Hammond did bring up Utah to his confidants, Winslow, in a suit. He brought up Utah for no reason that I could tell, unless maybe it was on the list of weather things.
The Utah was later, because the Utah they figured out because they got that information from the MALP.
Okay.
This is the small Stargate Science episode. The only Stargate Science issue I have with this episode is the MALP usually communicates to SGC through an open wormhole.
No satellites, right, yeah.
But in this case,
yeah.
The wormhole was between Madrona and Utah, nowhere near SGC. So I have no idea how the MALP was actually talking and sending back the video into the SGC. It's just the writers are used to doing that with them.
Oh, God, yeah. So, don't even tell me about this stuff, David. I don't want to know.
Sorry.
The thing where they were doing the records and the secondary and the tertiary records was to find where the Stargate energy signature, which is also bogus science, but anyway, was found, and that led them to the Nevada desert, which is where Nellis was, which is Area 51. So that's why they were going there.
Which implies the Stargate was there, but then we find out that the Stargate was never there.
It's not there, yeah.
I don't know why we went there, kind of. It was a little weird. This episode was a little fragile.
To insult Mayborn was why they went there, but yeah.
Yeah, it's for Mayborn.
And that was a great scene, so it was worth it. But yes, it didn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. Another thing, like, again, this episode was slow. Like, they spent so much time connecting the dots to get to the next place that they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It was all just nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, but they were so earnest about it. It's just funny.
The only thing I quite liked in this episode was they had the Antarctica accident, and that accident is now a piece of technology they can use moving forward.
Yeah, yep.
And I like that evolution of how Stargate takes things that happened in previous episodes.
Yes.
Is this is now a tool in our tool belt we can use. And that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
Another fun thing I have written down is when they were sort of invading the warehouse, which was also funny, like, hey, they finally get to use regular, like, Earth sets.
Yes.
For the strand of their arc. But when they were invading the warehouse, like, O'Neill is giving a whole bunch of these tactical hand signals. And yet, you know, Daniel is there with them. And I'm like, Daniel isn't going to know any of that stuff. He's just going to be like, what do you want me to do?
Well, he's been on the team for quite a while. Maybe he's had a basic tutorial.
You think he's learned some of them? Yeah. All right. Maybe.
Yeah, he's been maybe been put through a bit of boot camp.
Yeah. Yeah, but I did like what they were told, like, don't fire. So that's some suspense, right? Hey, we can't really defend ourselves. But O'Neill was willing to fire to keep them away from the doohickey.
The metal box, which he had no idea what was actually in it.
Well, yeah,
I liked Hammond's scene. So, like, initially I was thinking Hammond does really nicely in this because he's trying to thread that needle where he's allowed to follow the rules, but he'll bend it as much as he can. And he bends it more in this episode than most.
Oh, yeah.
But then I remembered, yes, but he's not mostly against the military. He's against a civilian organization. And in that case, he's far more willing to bend the rules. But yeah, he sets this very nice rules of engagement, which is basically you fire as a last absolute resort,
right,
which makes perfect sense given the context. And O'Neill just shoots away just to save a metal box that he hopes has the doohickey in it.
Well, he doesn't try to kill anybody. So yeah,
he doesn't try.
Like, yeah, they could have dropped some of those guys if they had wanted to before they got through the gate.
Right.
They avoided it.
They could have killed some to prevent them, or shot them in the leg at least to prevent them from escaping through the second Stargate, but they didn't.
They could have been all armed with Zat guns.
Yeah.
That would have been, yeah.
And stunned them. Yeah.
Boring, but yeah.
This has one addition to the lore, which is the DHD and the gate don't actually have to be connected whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
That the two things are entirely wirelessly connected to each other, which I never knew. I always assumed that maybe there's some wires under the DHD that then get shutted off to the gate, but nope.
Yeah.
Like, the DHD is sitting in a truck. The Stargate is on its side in a box, sealed, and it works just fine. And the plume coming up through the box was, I think, a beautiful little effect. I was quite happy with that.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah.
So you thought in all of those, like, scenes where they were, like, in a forest or in a desert, that somebody had just run a wire underground from the DHD to the...
You commission a base station, your crew comes in, they put it in place, they wire it up. That's how you commission these things, isn't it?
Okay, all right, yeah.
We'll get to a later episode when we discuss who did it.
Yeah, all right. And at the end, Mayburn says to Jack, orders change, every day is a new day, meaning someday I'll be on top again.
And this is basically Mayburn saying, you know, and I'll be back, children.
Yes.
And, you know, look forward to more Mayburn.
If only he had a mustache to twirl a little there.
Yeah, right.
My notes are, Mayburn is so creepy.
Yep.
Okay, so for the next two episodes, there appears to be some mild controversy over which order they're in. They are The Fifth Race and A Matter of Time. David, you pick which one we're going to do next.
Oh, my notes arbitrarily has, because that's what Andrew's told me to do. A Matter of Time. SG-10 is investigating a planet falling into a new black hole and failing to gate back to SGC due to time dilation. SGC gates to them, but they can't go there, can't close the gate, and can't save SG-10. Teal'c and Siler are both hurt. SGC gets massively time dilated and people keep coming and going after wild delays. A big lantern is hung to explain how this impossible relativity thing is happening.
Yeah.
And it is so big that they have to hang it twice.
Yes.
The plan is to blow up SGC, but Carter thinks that sucks. Carter leaves and then comes back with a new plan and a bomb. Teal'c and Siler return healed. O'Neill and Cromwell, an old friend that failed to save O'Neill, like O'Neill is failing to save SG-10, try and bomb the Stargate to bounce the wormhole to somewhere less horrible. Cromwell is lost, but O'Neill sets off the bomb and saves the SGC and Earth.
I question about the less horrible thing, because they're bouncing it off to a random planet, and I only hope that, you know, that planet that they end up sending the black hole to is uninhabited.
I did have exactly the same thought, but then when I was watching it the second time, they opened the gate, which means when they bounce it, they're changing not where the wormhole is connected to, but where they're connected to. So the wormhole connection goes nowhere because they're changing the other side. Now, the Antarctica thing does not really explain, and it's funny that this episode also does the Antarctica trick.
Yep.
But in this case, they do it to an already pre-existent wormhole, which is not what we've quite seen before. It was always before while a wormhole was opening. But I think what's happening here is this wormhole is moving from Earth to black hole to Earth to some other place. And therefore, the other planet is probably not going to get destroyed by the black hole. But they could write it that way, too, so we'll see going forward.
Okie dokie.
This episode has so much Stargate science. I adore the fact that they go onto this explanation as to time dilation has this effect. And some of it is so well done. Like, the time shifting of the radio signal across the wormhole is just beautiful. I even like the red shifting. That's kind of cool. The strange delays in communication. There are so many things that are great. But they need, for the plot, this time dilation to be happening on Earth, when that amount of time dilation would rip them all to mush.
Yep.
And they know it. The writers know it.
Yeah. Yes.
So they drop a big lantern on that, and then they even have Carter going over the entire thing again just to be clear. Okay, we know. Just let it go. Let it go. So I'm going
to
let it go.
We really want to write a black hole episode.
Yeah.
And in order for it to happen, they have to make up some stuff. And therefore, they will use their made-up alien technology to justify doing it. But they're a little self-conscious about it.
They are definitely self-conscious about it. They know that they're playing a bit loose here.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if you can take the lantern, if that lantern's okay,
yep,
and you can bathe in the light of that pretty lantern... Writing in this episode and the plotting is really good.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah.
They do so well.
I appreciated how O'Neill kept treating what Carter was saying as if it was scientific gobbledygook, when in fact it was totally simple and clear explanations of things,
yep,
that he should have been able to understand.
People are not always consistent. And I thought it was interesting how at the beginning he was trying to get Carter to go through very basically what a wormhole is. But then he recognized the black hole in the picture pretty instantly. And we know from previous episodes that he's interested in astronomy.
Astronomy, yeah.
I guess he just, you know, got interested in black holes and studied them, but hadn't gone on to cosmology and wormholes.
This might not be his first rodeo, but this is his second black hole in this show.
True.
That's true. He did get to do the thing with the eclipse.
Yeah.
Yep.
Of the black hole, something like that. Yeah. Some writer on the show really likes black holes.
This was early 90s. They got big around this time. It was a big thing.
They had already been big for millions of years, but yes.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? They don't have more gravity when they get smaller and turn into black holes.
Yep.
I was like,
But I appreciate that everyone died, because the act of the second star turning into a black hole wouldn't actually change the orbit of the planet. It wouldn't suck the planet in.
Yes.
But it would probably release enough radiation to just kill everyone there.
Mm-hmm.
In order for it to turn into a black hole, it has to sort of explode.
Something messy has to happen, basically. It's not going to be pretty. There's going to be a lot of radiation, yeah, a lot of x-rays. You don't want to be near it.
There's a lot of little nitpicks you can make on it, but you could tell, like, somebody was like, well, we need to write it in such a way that you can move a camera and have it focus on a really cool picture of a black hole.
Yep.
And they did it.
And they just do something so beautifully, and they write it well, where two separate teams got sent into the SGC.
Yes.
Which I like, by the way, that they pointed out very clearly that, yes, this is all directly underneath NORAD.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that had been confirmed earlier in the show, but yeah, they're literally underneath NORAD. But they sent two teams, and we see the second team that gets sent in first because Hammond went up.
Yes.
And then they mention that there was a first team, and then the first team shows up underground with Cromwell.
Poor Dr. Frazier.
Just nicely timed. And every time they send someone out, it takes longer for them to come back.
Yes.
And it's just well done.
Yeah. I thought you were on the phone.
Yeah, that was great.
Right.
That was a neat little line.
Hammond flies to Washington, has an all-night conference, and flies back in SGC land a few minutes.
That's also a good way of having a lot of the necessary stuff happen off-screen,
mm-hmm,
so that they can just come back and have the action happen on-screen. Yeah.
Right, right.
You always want your last countdown to be very dramatic.
Yeah.
And they get ready to do this five-minute countdown, and they're getting ready to do that five-minute countdown for like a third of this episode. And it works perfectly.
It does, mm-hmm, yeah. It works very nicely.
Like, normally that makes no sense when shows do that. But in this case, absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
The science and the suspense were good. I do feel that the character stuff, like Cromwell, was two cliches in a trench coat.
Mm.
And he just didn't act very well. And he didn't have good lines. And ugh, it was just really...
There wasn't a lot of time. Like, they had this yeah, thing, and they wanted to have this parallel with,
yeah,
with O'Neill losing SG-10. And it just, there was no time. They had, could have that one little confrontation where they yelled at each other. And I thought it was okay. I bought it. But I agree, it was very thin.
Oh, well.
Another character moment that I liked was when they realized what was happening with SG-10, and Hammond said to disengage the Stargate, and Carter says, no, this is an amazing science opportunity. We have an opportunity to study what's going on with the black hole. And Jack just says, we are witnessing men die in slow motion. And Carter obviously hadn't really considered that at all. She was so focused on the science, which as the...
Yeah, it's kind of her job.
That's her role.
Yeah.
And that is totally understandable. But, you know, So they were both, you know, right in their own narrow ways. But then that turns out to be moot because they can't disengage the Stargate.
I find it funny. There's one bit of Stargate science, which I think they shouldn't have done. They should have just removed the line, which is they're trying to take away power from the Stargate to close it. And I really liked earlier where when SG-10 opened the Stargate, it probably was opened for only a second because of the relative time dilation of who opens it and who closes it. But when SGC opens the Stargate, it just never closes.
Right.
So I quite like that too. But there is a line when they tried to take away power. Carter says, it must be deriving its power from the black hole itself.
Probably not.
No, don't write that.
Yeah. Yeah, I did like the vagueness when she said it's probably referring to how the time dilation didn't quite work right, where she said, it's probably a lensing effect of the Stargate.
Yeah, sure.
Yep. Bam, done. That's all you need to say about that.
It's a silly lantern, but I love it.
Yep.
It sounds so scientific, right? Lensing. That sounds really, really
cool.
There was another fun moment with Carter and Teal'c, when Teal'c is basically just coming to keep her company when she's trying to figure something out. And she kind of uses him as kind of the rubber ducky, you know, all right, I'm just going to say what I'm thinking to you. And Teal'c was like, yes, I don't understand, but yes, please go on. And it was just a nice little moment. Let those two actors kind of bounce off each other for a bit. And it didn't, you know, it didn't last very long and it didn't do very much, but it was a fun. I like those little moments when they can do them right.
Yep.
I don't think there's too many other moments where other characters get to do stuff.
There was the brief moment with Cromwell and O'Neill, where Cromwell starts, man, she is, and O'Neill ends, way smarter than we are, I know.
Yeah, there's a moment where, like, Carter is saying something, and after O'Neill before had shown how puzzled he was, he just sort of nods knowingly in front of Cromwell.
Right.
And Cromwell's like, yeah, don't even try it. That was a fun, because they're like, yeah, okay, that's what he would do.
I should double check who directed this one, because there's just so many nice subtleties. Like, yep. They have Siler and Teal'c get hurt. They even tell us it's going to take days for Teal'c to heal. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we see them later in the episode, and they're basically fine.
Right.
Because it's been half of a week.
Yeah. Yep.
Just nice consistency. Just strong writing of it all.
Yep. So I was curious and looked up on Wikipedia's disambiguation. And in addition to the Star Trek Next Generation 5th season episode titled A Matter of Time, there have been a documentary, a film starring Ingrid Bergman and Liza Minnelli, 4 books, 4 albums, and 8 songs all titled Matter of Time or A Matter of Time.
Okay.
I just thought that was...
Yeah, they weren't being really innovative with the name, but it's good.
Okay, so on to the other episode, which is The Fifth Race. And this turns out a lot of these that we've talked about today have been bottle episodes or bringing up eventual plot interests, continuing arc things. But this one is definitely a biggie. So, The Fifth Race, David, recap, please.
Okay. SG-1 gates to a room with a circle of old writing. O'Neill's head gets stuck in a machine and filled with something. Everyone remember that fun TNG episode with Barclay?
Nope.
They return to the SGC, but O'Neill is acting strangely, accidentally using alien words. O'Neill gets weirder and programs new Stargate addresses into the SGC computer. Carter and Teal'c start visiting these worlds looking for help. O'Neill builds a doohickey, while Carter gets stuck on a planet with a broken DHD and a really hot sun. O'Neill writes DHD repair instructions and then uses his doohickey to lock an 8th chevron, gating himself to the Asgardian planet Othala in the galaxy Ida. The Asgards are impressed, heal O'Neill, removing the ancient knowledge, and tell him about the alliance between the Asgards, the Nox, the Furlings, and the Ancients. Carter and O'Neill separately return safely. O'Neill tells them that humanity might not be ready, but they're here now.
I did appreciate that it was basically the equivalent of like somebody walking down the street who just happens to have a thing in their hand, which can take the information out of O'Neill's skull in like 2 seconds flat. So, yeah, that was fun.
There was such wonderful world building in this.
I thought you would say that.
And a lot of it is that one shot where we see the Asgardian heal O'Neill and we see the hand. Guess what? The hand has 4 fingers, because the math he was doing was base 8.
That's right.
Which is most likely to develop with an 8-fingered species. I thought that was pretty great. Someone was thinking there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but no. It was the ancients.
Yeah, but maybe the math.
Maybe they have 8 fingers.
Maybe I have seen other TV shows. The math they could be using, maybe it was just by a mathematician who happened to be an Asgardian. Like, I think there was a reason for them doing that little bit of 10 equals 8. Being in base 8.
Okay.
And I think that was because someone said, oh, wait a second, our Asgardian puppets have 8 fingers. And I think it works quite nicely.
Okay.
But the one thing I really liked in that shot was we see the Asgardian's hand and they have a dish thing and it absolutely stinks like the Gould.
Yes.
Use those hand things.
Yes.
As a gross hack to try and have what the Asgardians have.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like, this is the closest we can get to how the great Asgardian tech, and we're just this bad imitation. And I was just so impressed.
Yep. Well, it does seem a slightly poor design that the thing in the wall would think that Jack was ready for all this knowledge and forcibly inject it all into his brain.
And throw it when he's not ready, yeah. Yeah.
Leaving him badly damaged in the process, yes.
When they wouldn't take a Jaffa.
Right.
It was written into the episode that there was some vetting going on in these devices, but mm-hmm. not enough,
but
apparently.
Not quite good enough vetting.
It is interesting because we've seen how the Asgards do vetting with their funky tests and holograms and all of that. Like, that's how the Asgardians would do the test. But the ancients seem kind of jerks. And this is a lot more harsh.
Yeah.
I did like how it took kind of evolving understanding of what it meant to have this thing downloaded into his head. Like, mm-hmm. they only figure out as they go that it's, well, okay, it's language. No, okay, it's more than language. It's other stuff too. And then figuring out that it's the ancients. Now, Daniel was definitely speculating more than he should have with this stuff. But
perhaps.
Again, I hate that about science fiction shows where they just like do these incredible leaps because they need to for the plot because they don't have enough information, but they want to talk about the cool stuff that's going on. And so I think that's a bit of a sin in this episode as well. But of course, then it all gets confirmed by the Asgard at the end. So it's all right. So this is the first time I think we're hearing about something, a race called the Ancients.
Yep.
And this is the first time we're hearing about an 8th chevron.
Right. Yeah, I was surprised David didn't bring that up too. But maybe you just hadn't gotten to it yet.
Yeah.
I was blown away that there was an 8th chevron action in the second season of the show.
Yeah, it seems really early. Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen later shows where there are 8th chevrons and it's like, well, this must have been something they added like in the 9th season or the 10th season. I'm like, watching the second season going, oh my.
Yep.
I was quite surprised, though it does seem clearly harder and harder every time they try and dial an 8th chevron. It seems more difficult in the other shows, whereas here it seemed pretty darn easy. But what do you do?
Well, they had that device from O'Neill.
The doohickey.
Yeah.
To power it. Yeah, the new doohickey, which glows when you turn it on and hums. Yeah, that shows it's very powerful.
Yep.
I think they are trying to make it clear that it's difficult to get there. And of course, that the SGC has no way of getting to an 8th chevron address on their own at all, which is why
yep.
you're basically not going to hear about it again for a while.
But I do love that they add this database. Like, they have this thing where, okay, there's all these sets of worlds. We're just going to be clear. Okay, now there are a huge set of gates available that yep. the Gould don't know about.
Right.
And so there's a huge new set of opportunities for where they're going to be going in the future, which I thought was a nice primary functional change of this episode beyond just the information that they're giving us.
Yeah, no, the writers were like, well, we kind of need to, you know, give ourselves more of an open area to explore
yep.
for upcoming seasons, and this is how we'll do it. So yeah, I do feel a little bad for both Captain Carter and for Amanda Tapping, in that poor Amanda Tapping gets the B plot where they don't even show her on another world, really. They just show her in a TV screen.
Right.
And so that's all she gets. That's all you're going to get for this episode, because we don't even want to spend the money to show another planet. And then, of course, poor Captain Carter gets to be on a planet that's going to roast. So just not having a good day.
Daniel had his
yep.
vacation or whatever it was in a matter of time where he was off doing something somewhere for almost all of the episode.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe the schedules just didn't work out or something.
I also really liked the scene, and it just seemed out of nowhere with like O'Neill and Teal.
Boxing.
Where O'Neill is teaching him boxing. And I thought there was more to that scene. I remembered O'Neill getting knocked down multiple times. Maybe that's in subsequent scenes. I don't know. Like, that was such a good comedic scene because Teal'c is just so obviously like, what are you doing, Jack? Why are you subjecting me to this? And so you kind of get the feeling that he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just make sure you don't want to do this again because I'm going to hit you really hard. And we'll see if that works to dissuade you from doing this to me. It's just great. Again, I think Christopher Judge does get some chances to be funny. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly, unfortunately, just sort of acting the same way he always acts in this character. But I do think there's some timing aspects to this and some expressions that he gets to be funny. And, I laughed. It was a funny scene.
It's a nice little light scene. And it gives us some time to show a change over time for O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
They just needed to spend a bit of time where we see O'Neill getting weirder and weirder. And that was a nice way of just, let's give this situation, here's another bit of a few minutes where you can start seeing more of that transition as O'Neill is really concerned about bending his Khozars.
The boxing is absolutely not a function of him getting weirder because of the sailing device.
No.
That's just O'Neill being kind of a silly person.
Yes.
So, yeah.
It might have been a bit because he seemed stranger even in the earlier meeting. Like, it works as doing something new. Like, here, let's do this thing we've never done before. And that sort of fits well with just a slightly
off kilter. Yeah.
Off the norm. Off kilter. Exactly.
Yeah. And then I think Frasier's in this episode as well. We get a decent amount of Frasier in these episodes.
We do.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of she's in these episodes. She's still not actually doing all that much, but she's in them. And always with these things, they're like, well, I can't find anything wrong with him. And of course, there's always something wrong with him.
Right. Right.
But can't find it. and then Frasier's thing with, like, you know, humans only use 10 to 20% of their brain.
Now, don't blame that on Frasier. That's the script writers.
That's the script writers, yes. I was like, wrong. That's not how that works. But yes.
There must have been, like, one paper somewhere someone wrote in a stupid book, and mm-hmm. that has been used in how many TV shows?
So many shows, yeah.
It deserves its own trope. It probably has one, like the 10% brain use trope. I should look it up. It's just bizarre that got so much culture got connected to that silly idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, as you're saying, like, black holes got popular. I think that idea got really popular, you know, maybe around this time or maybe just forever. Who knows? But yeah, it makes me laugh whenever I hear it because, like, no, that's not it. And so this is another episode where Richard Dean Anderson gets to kind of act weird because he gets to do that multiple times per season. I think he did a good job here too because he has to kind of show that gradual degradation of his mind. It seems like he's got a headache, right? Like he's just more and more kind of holding his head and grimacing and everything as we go. I think he really sold the concept. Like, a lot of this episode relies on him making this not seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
And he did. It, you know, again, whatever they were paying him, they got their money's worth.
The slipping in words seemed a little silly, but that's on the writers. But when he just started speaking ancient, I think he pulled it off really quite nicely.
Yeah, right? Because the character would never be able to do that. So, and I do think it's funny that Daniel was like, no, wait, let me learn more about the language from, you know, poor O'Neill as my guinea pig. Because of course Daniel would do that. There's one also scene at the end where O'Neill is going through the gate and Daniel kind of stops him and says, you know, you may not be able to come back. So, you know, he like wished him well or something about how he interacted with him at the very end because he knew that he might be seeing him for the last time. And I thought both actors handled that really, that was a nice moment for those characters.
You know what these people really need is a protocol where you can't gate back to us directly because of the iris. So we periodically send people to this place and we can meet you there if you need to. Like, I don't quite understand.
Yeah.
This show always has the problem where if they're going to a location, they always only go back to that one location, even though they could always at any moment go to any planet with a Stargate. It just seems strange to me that this whole, we can't assume that we're going to be able to receive you back here. Well, fine. You can go hang out with the Latent Dark people for a week and then meet up with SGC there or something. It's beyond me that some protocol or you can just go to Abydos. I don't know. It just seemed strange to me that the iris is so limited.
Does it though? Yeah. I think I'm going to call this the Zat Gambit.
Yeah, maybe.
Because it's the thing where the writers want to keep things simple and want to keep things suspenseful. So they're going to ignore a slightly more complicated solution that would just make everything fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I looked it up and 90% of your brain has its own page in TV tropes.
There we go.
There are many entries.
Do not list them all.
It says the trope name comes from the oft-repeated but false assertion that humans only use 10% of their brains. A misquote of Dale Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Oh, God.
So no one even intentionally wrote it.
So that's an old trope.
Not even like that's a scientific paper or anything. That's
right. Of
somebody
course.
Making something up.
Not even what he said. It's a misquote.
Right. It's totally wrong.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How a trope is born.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the great potential thing where, you know, the Asgardian says that device wasn't meant for you, your brain couldn't handle it, but he's kind of impressed that Jack even made it here. And he says that your species has great potential. We know because we've studied you, which is kind of ominous.
True.
Well, it's especially true. Ominous from a bunch of aliens that look like Roswell Grays.
Yes, exactly.
We've probed you.
But yeah. They don't go into that. But Jack argues back, yeah, that's flattering, but actually... You need to go a step further because we're out there and we're curious and we're not going away. So deal with it.
I really, really, really loved this scene with the Asgardians. And I don't know, like, are these two Asgardian leaders or are they just two people who happen to be walking down the street by the Stargate? It's unclear. But it doesn't matter because these Asgardians just have such gravitas. I'm truly impressed by the puppet work in this show. They look so great. I just, I don't know why.
Yeah. I'm really glad they didn't try to use CGI for them.
No, it was too early. They would have been horrible.
Yeah.
No, this was the way to do it. And they look really quite good.
Yeah, somehow just with little eye movements and stuff, they seem to have personalities.
Although they never moved their feet. Right? Like they're rooted to one spot.
They don't need to move their feet if they don't have to.
I mean, they're Muppets, basically, right? They're Muppets.
But they're great. And I really quite like this conversation.
Yeah.
And this is progression. We're in season two now. No one is specifically saying you are either young or primitive.
Mm-hmm.
You are up to great potential.
Yeah, right.
Like, this is a massive improvement,
given
how they have been treated by the Nox. I think this showed progress. And I think that actually is what was being communicated here, is we see now a bit of progress where humans are surprisingly quickly, perhaps, making progress where now they're maybe impressing these Asgardians just a little bit. And I think that was a nice touch.
Yep. We're going back to stasis in quite a few ways because, like, okay, you're not going to contact us again. You don't actually know how to reach us at all, so we're going to be back to normal episodes.
Yeah, but once again, the universe has opened up a bit more.
Yep.
I really was disappointed myself that it didn't quite occur to me that the Nox was one of the four people, but of course they were. I like that list, that it's the Asgard, the Nox. I have absolutely no idea who the Furlings are. I got nothing. And the Ancients I know a bit more about from later series, of course. But it was nice having them all listed out. I don't know whose writing is which. We know what the Asgard writing is because it's in runes. And the Ancients seem to be the blocky techno ones. So I'm tempted to go back and try and figure out what type of writing the Nox used, because we saw them as kind of druids living in the forest. We didn't quite see their city and where their writing was. So we didn't even see any of their writing in that previous episodes.
Yeah, I would presume that they had some kind of written language in the past, but I'm not even sure they use it anymore.
Yeah, that's also possible.
Well, again, there was a big ship in the air that we didn't ever see anything to do with. And
yeah,
presumably, if you're going to maintain giant ship technology, you probably need writing, but okay.
But they don't bother using it if they don't want to.
Well, the little encampments on the ground don't need writing. They're roughing it. They're camping.
Yeah, exactly. They're literally just camping. That was a family camping out, camping trip.
They're just camping.
It got very complicated.
Yeah.
This was great. I could watch these Jackin people trying to chat with these Asgardian puppets all day long. So I was happy to see this. This was great fun.
Okay. Yeah. This was another callback to the, the Torment of Tantalus was the season one episode where they did the meaning of life stuff. And this was the same sort of sense of wonder, I think, that they're trying to evoke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they handled it pretty well. They, it was a hopeful episode at the end. And it was one episode where there's no real enemy except sort of the situation.
Right.
Those are kind of nice episodes because, again, in the earlier episodes, you know, we have four episodes and in two of the episodes, like, we're the baddies, I think is the idea.
Mm.
And then the third one, gravity is the baddie, and then no baddie. And so, yeah, it's an interesting spread considering that we've had a lot of episodes this season which also have, you know, the world is our enemy and...
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other stuff. So again, they're mixing it up And I think they're, in terms of that, I mean, I think they do a lot of these episodes about as well as they do, you know, some of their episodes. So they're not just going into foreign territory and just screwing up. They're handling about as well as they usually do.
There's a possible improvement for how this team copes with the stuff. Yeah, this was a fun trio of episodes I watched. Touchstone is a little fragile. A Matter of Time is great, but you have to stomach what they're feeding you. And I thought the Fifth Race was just all fun.
Okay. Yeah, and I would generally put Fifth Race above Matter of Time just because of the characterization issues. Which, if you were going to rank them, David, what order would you put those two in?
Oh, I don't know. I would probably rank the Fifth Race before A Matter of Time. But A Matter of Time was a harder episode. Like, if you rated these as levels of difficulty, A Matter of Time was a wickedly hard episode to write and make. And they, given a couple issues, I think did amazingly well.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't think the Fifth Race was quite as much of a challenge per se.
Right.
I'll have to think of my ratings as we get Fair. As rankings as we get closer to the end of season two.
That's right. Well, how close are we? This is the 16th episode out of 2022.
Six more episodes.
Yeah. So yeah, we're getting there.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to them. The next is The Serpent Song. That sounds like fun.
Hey, yes. Guess who the enemy is?
I can't imagine.
don't even. Yeah, let's just wait for it. Okay.
All right. Well, I guess that's going to about do it for this time. I always enjoy these discussions, and I hope y'all did too.
Indeed.
Yep. If our listeners would like to continue the discussions with us, we are on Twitter.
We're on Twitter at Stargate_SG_fun.
We'd love to hear from you. And yeah, I think that's going to about do it for now. And we will be talking with you later.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.